All right. Well, welcome everyone. It's good to see us all out here for another Bible class this evening. And we've got our brother David Hill continuing his series on the man David. And he said he doesn't have a reading for this evening, but the topic that he's particularly focusing on this evening is David and Jonathan. So looking forward to it. Thanks.
Well, good evening, everybody. It's great to be back with you again. And as Seb said, we'll be looking tonight certainly at David, but in particular, his relationship with Jonathan and their incredible friendship, which is one of the most extraordinary friendships really that we find in the whole Bible, a really beautiful relationship that we hope we'll get to know a little bit better today. So if you are turning up your Bibles or digitally doing it, 1 Samuel 13 is where we're going to start, because that's where we're introduced to Jonathan, and in particular his first characteristic. We'll see that there's really four key characteristics or qualities of Jonathan. Three are very apparent, one comes out a little bit later, and the first one is courage, because we find here in 1 Samuel 13, and if you're looking in verse 2, that with just 1,000 men, Jonathan defeated the garrison of the Philistines at Geba. But we read in verse 4 very quickly, the character of Saul kicks in. And in verse 4, we read that all Israel heard it said that Saul had defeated the garrison. So not Jonathan, Saul. And that's where the second characteristic of Jonathan comes in, his lack or complete lack of jealousy, his humility, we might say, because there's no jealousy whatsoever from Jonathan. He doesn't try to correct everyone and claim the victory. He lets that pass. And later in verse 9, after in his anxiety, Saul has offered the burnt offering. We have the famous words in verse 14 where Samuel says to Saul, "Now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people." It's really worth pausing here and reflecting that this news would have absolutely got very, very quickly, and we know that from the record to Jonathan, but there's no mention of any jealousy. He's completely humble about that. He accepts it. He accepts his father taking all the credit. He doesn't claim any injustice. "Look what I've just done with just 1,000 men, my extraordinary courage in conquering this garrison." Completely silent. And we'll see that really his courage is matched by this very, very humble attitude. But because of this great conquest, certainly the Philistines noted that in a big way. So have a look back in verse 5. It says that the Philistines, verse 4 perhaps to start, Israel became a stench to the Philistines. Pretty strong language. They stunk in the eyes of the Philistines. And then verse 5, they mustered to fight with Israel 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, troops like the sand of the seashore. And verse 6, the men of Israel saw that they were in trouble, for the people were hard pressed. Verse 7 says, all could be found trembling. And then verse 8, all began scattering from Saul. And if we skip over to verse 15, by this time, Saul numbered the people and found that those present with him were just 600 men. So in front of this huge force, everyone who could deserted. And let's look at some of these words, because they're pretty strong. The word trouble in verse 6 means to cramp. It's the word used of a siege. You're under siege. The word hard-pressed, also in verse 6, means to drive. It has the idea to tyrannize or be under tyranny. Such was their feeling. So we can see the people of Israel shuddering,
terrorized in abject terror in front of this huge force, and most flee, leaving just 600. And against the backdrop of Saul taking all the credit, the kingdom being stripped essentially from Jonathan, he would no longer be the prince who would rule, who do we think is in the 600? Do you think we would walk away feeling hard done by? Perhaps, but not Jonathan. He's right there. Verse 16, Saul and Jonathan, his son. And we'll see that refrain used so many times. Saul and Jonathan, his son. Despite how terribly and unjustly Jonathan is treated by his father, Jonathan is incredibly loyal. So that's his third quality. His first, courage. The second, no jealousy. The third, extraordinary loyalty, even when it was undeserved by his father, Saul. So have a look now, turn across to 1 Samuel 14. And we see right up front, verse 1, Jonathan, the son of Saul. There it is again. That's how he's introduced. Jonathan, the son of Saul. He said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison." But we read down in verse 3, at the end, the people knew not that Jonathan had gone. So we get again another insight. This very loyal, humble, courageous man was never out for a claim. He didn't announce, "I'm going off to take on another garrison," boastfully, so that he might accrue a following. No one knew. He did it by stealth. He was never out for any personal glory. Now in verse 4, and we won't read every single word or we'll be here for a while, but in verse 4, you can see it says that within the passes there was a rocky crag on one side that had one of the garrisons on it, and then there was a rocky crag on the other side. And verse 5 tells us that on one side was Michmash and on the other side was Geba. So these two garrisons, Jonathan had already conquered one, Geba, and he says to his armor bearer, "Now let's go and take on Michmash." It's the turn for Michmash. And so him and his armor bearer, we can imagine, stealthily heading up this river pass till they stood right up, looking up at this rocky outcrop where the garrison of Michmash stood quite ominously, clearly at an advantage compared to where Jonathan and his armor bearer were. Look at their incredible faith, though. It's quite amazing. Verse 6, Jonathan says to the young man, "It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few." And here there's two of them. I mean, it's extraordinary, right? I mean, we've got to make these stories real to us. They're not, it's not like a children's book or a little pop-up picture book that we would think is a fiction. This is real. Two men against a garrison, and they're at a distinct disadvantage looking up at this garrison. But look at the acceptance also of Jonathan of God's will. "It may be that the Lord will work for us." That's extraordinary, because if God didn't work for them, what was the alternative? Certain death. I mean, this was, to all appearances, a suicidal mission. And I think this is where we get an insight into Jonathan and why David's heart was subsequently knit to the heart of Jonathan, because God said, "I'm going to appoint a king who's a man after my own heart." And Jonathan's heart was very much like David's, incredibly loyal, incredibly courageous, and very accepting of the will of God. And look at his goal. Just like David's, we saw that with the incident with Goliath last class. He says, "Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving." The motivation of Jonathan was exactly the same as David, the salvation of the people, which is why both Jonathan and David are remarkable types or symbols of our Lord Jesus Christ. Their whole motivation was the salvation of the people. And you get a sense, we will talk a lot about the relationship between David and Jonathan, but look at the relationship between the armor bearer and Jonathan. It's quite extraordinary. This young man, we don't know much at all about him other than this extraordinary act of faith. But verse 7, here's the respect this armor bearer had for Jonathan. Do all that is in your heart. Do as you wish. I am with you heart and soul. How good would it be to have an armor bearer like that? I'm right here with you heart and soul. We're absolutely in this together. We'll fight. If God is with us, we'll prosper. If not, I'm ready to die with you. That's the respect that Jonathan commanded. A very, very impressive, powerful leader. Now, verse 8 tells us that they devise a really courageous plan, because actually this plan calls for the most likely response for the Philistines, which would be the most confronting outcome. It's probably not the scheme you and I would come up with, because in verse 8, they say, we will show ourselves to the Philistines, right up there, whole garrison of them, up on this rocky crag. And verse 10, if they say to us, come up to us, we'll go up. Well, what do you think the Philistines would say? Of course they'd say, come on up. We'll get rid of you, which is exactly what they say, right? But Jonathan uses that as the test, the sign. So the most likely outcome is that they're going up. Jonathan designs it such that it's almost certain that they would go up. But look at the confidence. We will go up. For if that's what they say, we're going to interpret that the Lord has given them into our hand. This shall be the sign for us. Quite amazing. Probably we would say, if they're not interested, we'll go up, because we've got half a chance, because we might surprise them or take them by stealth. Quite the opposite. So to all appearances, again, doomed. But just like God, who didn't look at Eliab and say, yep, this is an impressive person, I'm going to choose him, God looked on the heart. Same with Jonathan. He doesn't look at the appearances. Hundreds of men versus two, he has faith. He sees the unseen. He sees God and the angels and has confidence. So how does it play out? Verse 11, they showed themselves. The Philistines say very mockingly, and this gives us an insight into what was happening. Look, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they've hidden themselves. Verse 12, come up to us and we will show you a thing or two. It's very mocking, come up and we will kill you. So with exceptional faith, verse 13, they scale the rocky cliff. It says, on hands and feet. What bravery. At any time, they were at risk of bows and arrows or javelins being thrown down at them. They scale hands and feet up the cliff and look at what they achieve. Verse 14, about 20 men fell in front of Jonathan and his armor bearer within about half a furrow's length in an acre of land. So this was hand-to-hand combat. Almost as soon as they scaled the crop, they were into it. But they were obviously extraordinary soldiers, empowered by God, and slew 20 men straight away. And then an extraordinary thing happens. God and the angels go to work. Verse 15, there was a panic in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison, the raiders trembled, the earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. The word great is mighty. It's the word Elohim, perhaps an allusion to the angels, although we know that's used generically as well for a mighty panic, a huge panic. Verse 19, the tumult increased more and more. Verse 20, every Philistine sword ended up against his fellow, and there was great confusion. So, an extraordinary victory. an amazing victory. But the story doesn't end there. It finishes in a very sobering way that gives us an insight into the arrogance and the desire for self in Saul and the integrity of Jonathan. So verse 24, Saul really wants to capitalize on this and really get after the Philistines and show them a thing or two. So he makes a really rash vow. Verse 24, "Cursed be anyone who eats any food until it's evening, and I am avenged of my enemies." So not a great idea to an army to have them almost starving hungry. I mean, this is extraordinary combat, but he's trying to capitalize on the situation and makes another rash statement and a really bad vow. But verse 25, when all the people came to the forest, it's quite a curious little story. There was honey on the ground. So there's this honey on the ground, and we know honey. In fact, when I watch Ed's Gridiron, they literally pass honey around and literally squeeze it in as an energy boost. And so the soldiers would have thought, wow, this is awesome. Honey, let's get that in, a little bit of a boost. But then they think, whoa, no, we can't do that. We can't do that because of this big statement that Saul has made. We'll be cursed. We would be fear of our life. But tragically, verse 27, Jonathan had not heard his father charge the people with the oath. So he put out the tip of his staff, dipped it in the honeycomb, and put his hand to his mouth. Simple thing. But then in verse 37, when Saul inquired of God, "Shall I go up again after the Philistines?" God didn't answer him. So Saul's quite concerned. So he challenges verse 38, the leaders of the people, "How has this sin arisen?" And he says again, really rashly, verse 39, "Even if it's Jonathan, my son, he shall surely die." That's how serious I am. You know, big tough guy Saul, right? "I will even take the life of my own son." But as testament to how the people feel about Jonathan, look at the loyalty they have for Jonathan. But he never, ever, ever sought to exploit this for himself. The people loved him. We'll see in a moment they were prepared to die for him. So verse 39, "There was not a man among all the people who answered Saul a word." Not a word. No one was willing to give up Jonathan. However, he was ultimately revealed as the culprit. And verse 43, verse 43, what Saul says. "So Saul said to Jonathan, 'Tell me what you have done. Tell me what you have done.'" And here, all of those qualities, his courage, his humility, his loyalty, his integrity comes to the fore. Verse 43, "I tasted a little honey." There's almost just a subtle point there, just a tiny nudge from Jonathan. "I tasted a little honey." And then these extraordinary words, "Here I am, I will die." This is a guy who's just conquered two garrisons, fought in this very war. He's tapped his staff into a little bit of honeycomb, but out of respect to his dad, his father, who had made this vow, "Here I am, I will die." Saul's response, extraordinary. Verse 44, "You shall surely die." What an ominous situation. But the people, and here it is again, the people can hold back no longer. They love Jonathan, just like David did. You can see from this why David's heart was subsequently knit to Jonathan's. The people can't hold back. Verse 45, look at their words. It's so beautiful. "Shall Jonathan die, who has worked this great salvation in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day." Beautiful words. And then the record says, "So the people ransomed Jonathan so that he did not die." Amazing. The power of the people irresistible. Saul could not overcome that. And Jonathan lives on. But note how you see that loyalty. But this is a man who was stripped of the right to the throne, never complained, never pushed back on God, never pushed back on his father. Amazing, amazing example. Now that makes it very obvious why, because we did last class Saul and David and Goliath. If we skip that story and go to when Jonathan and David meet, which is in chapter 18, verse 1, we see that background, and it's obvious why we read in verse 1, as soon as David had finished speaking to Saul, look at this, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. He saw in this courageous young man, David, a man after his own heart, a man after God's own heart, and their hearts were knit together in love. We know in Ephesians 5, it says that husbands should love their wives as their own soul. That's how Jonathan loved David, as a husband loves their wife. Incredible affection. Jonathan admired this young man so much. He saw in him the exact same courage, the exact same humility, and the exact same loyalty. Look at verse 3. Jonathan and David made a covenant. And then verse 4, it's very symbolic. Jonathan stripped himself of the royal robes, the robe that was upon him, and gave it to David. And then he also gave his own garments, his sword, his bow, his girdle. So the robe that he wore was the princely robe that identified him as the future king, the prince. He knew that this was the man that Samuel had said in 1 Samuel 13, I will choose a man after my own heart. He knew right there and then that this was the man. So this begins at this moment, as I said in my opening remarks, one of the most extraordinary friendships in the whole of the Bible. And it's here that I thought I would just pause and just make a small reflection around the importance, particularly for men, of friendships, male and male friendships, mateships. You might think it's somewhat strange to have a little tangent on that topic. But my observation in my life, and I may be completely deluded, but I find that with so many men compared to women, women seem, we might say our sisters, seem very, very good at remaining in contact, catching up for lunch, dinners, movies, together, whatever it happens to be. But sometimes as men, particularly in the instance if there's a marriage breakdown, you can find a lot of men who subsequent to that are very lonely and therefore very vulnerable. And the glue of a true mateship, a true male friend that's very precious with a real mental, emotional, and spiritual connection, without that, as a glue to the faith, they can be very vulnerable even when it comes to our faith. And that's why I think, like Jeff is here, things like Men with the Master, etc., I think are amazing. For men to support men, also women at the Well and various other things as well, are really important. Now, of course, I recognise for those of us as men who are privileged to be married and to have children, our obligation, our first responsibility is to our wife and children. But that doesn't mean that we don't value male friendship. It's so important to be able to confide in someone who's walked the same road as us, is subject to the same challenges, temptations as us. Things like the Proverbs where it talks about sword sharpening sword, or faithful are the wounds of a friend. Very, very powerful. But sometimes a mate can come alongside and ask how you truly are, or share an observation or two about where you might have changed, or make an inquiry that can sometimes cut to the heart, but be exactly what you need at that time. And also, just at a purely practical level, for our mental health, to have great mates that you look forward to spending time with, doing things and having a great time, I think is fabulous. And the Bible talks about that in terms of friendship. It talks about a friend being of more value than fine gold. And I think that's absolutely true in terms of our mental health. And for our sisters, I certainly believe it's worth encouraging that. I think, you know, a mentally healthy husband, father is a good thing. And certainly I find it's my experience. I'm looking at two of my incredibly good mates here in the audience, that when we have those friendships, it really, really helps, really helps. And, you know, I think, Timmy, of one notable fishing trip, I was at a pretty low point. Off we went for 3 days, and it was, you know, chicken soup for the soul, just with your mates, in a different type of world than what I often work in at work, but it's the most precious times in your life. And I think the chats you can often have to build each other up and support each other are really powerful. And for David and Jonathan, their relationship was extraordinary. And so to Barge and Timmy, and I suspect Kerry might be listening, at this ecclesia, I'm privileged to have three really great mates, and I thank you blokes. We never quite appreciate, I don't think, how much true friends really mean. Our next encounter is in chapter 19, and this is where it really starts going sort of south for David in a pretty big way. We read in chapter 19, verse 1, Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, there it is again, Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. That's the instruction. Jonathan, kill David. That's a direct order from the king, his father, no less. That would be really, really tough. So what does Jonathan do? Have a look. It's really amazing. Verse 2, Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. The word much, we saw it last class, means vehemently. He passionately loved David. So Jonathan goes to David and he tells David, he risks his life, Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Therefore, be on your guard. Stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And then look what he does. The Hebrew here is the exact word we find in the Greek, which I'm sure many of us would be familiar with, parakletos, to exhort, to come to one side, to advocate. That's what Jonathan does. He says, I will go out and stand beside my father, a mediator, an intercessor, just like the Lord Jesus. I will speak to your defense. Look at that. I will speak to my father about you. So he's the ultimate advocate. He risks his life to intercede for David. Verse 4, Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father. And look at his incredibly well-reasoned argument and logic. He says, let not the king sin against his servant David. He hasn't sinned against you. His deeds have brought good to you. He took his life in his hand and struck down the Philistines and the Philistine, Goliath. And the Lord worked a great salvation for all Israel. You, Dad, saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause? That's amazing. I've got to tell you, I'm not very good at this. My wife, Elizabeth, is way better at this than I am. You think of this scenario. David is absolutely in the gun of Saul. Kill him. You know, that you imagine the abuse, the vitriol directed towards David. And we know that whenever you try to intervene in a situation like that, you put yourself in the crosshairs. Sometimes, when someone tries to break up a fight or to intervene or arbitrate or be a peacemaker, all of a sudden the crosshairs can turn on you and you can cop it, and it can be brutal. And so what a lot of us do is stand away in silence. We do nothing for selfish reasons, because we don't want to make ourselves the target. We don't want to be vulnerable. Not so with Jonathan. We saw earlier, he said, "Here I am, I'm ready to die." In this situation, there's no question he risks his life by mediating, interceding, and being a peacemaker for David. Look at verse 7. On this occasion, for a very short time, it was successful. Jonathan brought David to Saul. We know with things when we talk about the intercession of Christ, that Christ brought God to us and brings us to God. This is exactly what's happening here. Jonathan, standing at the side of Saul, brings David to his side and therefore to God and to Saul. And it says, and he was in his presence as before. But sadly, with Saul, with his mental ill health that we talked about last class, it didn't last long. Verse 10, bang. Three verses later, in a fit of jealous rage, Saul again, in the language, this is the ESV, sought to pin David to the wall with the spear. But David eluded Saul and fled and escaped that night. Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him, that he might kill him in the morning. Now, this is where, to do a study of the life of David, you have to look at the Psalms as well, because it gives us so much more colour to what was really going on, because that's all we read here. But David wrote a whole psalm about this incident. You don't need to turn it up. I'll read it for you. But Psalm 59 begins this way. A miktam of David, when Saul sent men to watch his house in order to kill him. So he wrote a psalm about this, and it brings it to life. This was terrifying. And it went on and on and on and on for David for years. So in Psalm 59, verse 2, save me from bloodthirsty men. Verse 3, they lie in wait for my life, fierce men. Verse 6, each evening they come back again and again. And what did they do? Howling like dogs, prowling about the city. Verse 7, bellowing with their mouths, with swords in their lips. Verse 12, uttering cursing and lies. That's what we should think of when we read about David fleeing from Saul. The same band of 3,000 fierce men followed him around every city, every cave, every mountainside, yelling out threatenings for David to either be given up by those that were harboring him or for him to give up and finally succumb to the pressure and walk out to face these fierce men. A terrifying experience every night. So often he writes that he couldn't sleep. He laid in his bed in terror because of this bloodthirsty group of men that were out for his life, mercenaries sent by Saul. Not very nice at all. That's what David was going through. Have a look at chapter 20, and we'll look at verse 1, because this is our next encounter where David finds Jonathan. It says, David came and said before Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my guilt? And what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" So David risks his life to find Jonathan. And this is where this fourth quality comes through. And it's a little bit of a playful thing to say, perhaps, but we really see that there's a fourth quality of Jonathan, which is really sweet. He's very innocent, no guile at all. Yes, courageous. Yes, loyal. Yes, no jealousy, total humility. But there's this beautiful innocence about him. Because David says, like, what have I done? Why is your father seeking my life? Jonathan's response, verse 2, far from it. You will not die. Behold, like, and this is the innocence. Like, my father does nothing, great or small, without disclosing it to me. Like, you see that innocence? Like, no guile. Like, I'd know about it, David. It's all good. And why should my father hide this from me? very innocent, almost naive, some commentators describe, in a lovely way. He says it's not so. Whereas David is the opposite. Remember with David, one of the first characteristics that describes of David is that he had great discernment. He could discern good and evil, truth and error, right? He was very cunning, a lot of guile, right? Whereas Jonathan, none of it. David says, hang on a minute, no, Jonathan, sweet of you, but what does he say? Verse 3, your father knows well that I have found favor in your eyes. And I'm going to tell you what he thinks. There's David, like classic, totally opposite. This is what your dad thinks. I'm telling you. Your dad thinks, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. That's why you've got no idea, Jonathan. But truly, there is a step between me and death. Now, the word grieve there literally means to carve. We might, in the sort of modern English, say to be gutted. Saul's not going to tell you, Jonathan, because he knows that you'd be gutted. He's not going to reveal it because he knows how loyal you are to me, along with your loyalty to your father. But then look at Jonathan's response. Maybe his innocence and naivety is smashed. How does he respond? Verse 4, whatever you say, I will do it for you. Whatever you say, I'll do it for you. Most beautiful words. Whatever you say, I'll do it for you. Such was his love for David. Unconditional, unconstrained. So David says in his reply, he finishes it in verse 8 with a very heartfelt plea. He says, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant. He reminds Jonathan of the covenant. Then he says, an extraordinary thing, but if there is guilt in me, kill me yourself. For why should you bring me to your father? He knows that Jonathan was so loyal to his father. And there's an element of doubt here. None of that in Jonathan, but in David. If there's anything wrong, if you see any guilt in me, Jonathan, kill me now. But definitely do not bring me to your father. I couldn't cope with that act of betrayal from my best friend. How do you think Jonathan would have reacted to that? It's like, are you kidding me? I would never do that to you. And that's what he says. That's exactly what he says in verse 9. But before we get there, David's so careful and skilled with his words. The word deal kindly is the very well-known Hebrew word kesed, which is often translated in many translations steadfast love, or more modern translations get it, I believe, even better, loyal love, loyal love. You know, it's steadfast, it's constant, it's loyal, and it's a loyal love. So David says, show me your loyal love, me, more than your dad, right? And look how they use this word back on each other, right? So David's saying, be loyal to me. Jonathan says, kill you? Far be it from me. If I knew it was determined by my father that harm should come to you, would I not tell you? Of course I would. Then he turns it back on David. He says, however, verse 14, if I am still alive, I'm the one at risk here because I'm going to defy my father. In fact, meeting with you, I'm in fear of my life. If I am still alive, you show me the loyal love. He uses the exact same word back on him. You show me the loyal love of the Lord that I may not die, and do not cut off your loyal love from me and my house forever when the Lord cuts off every one of your enemies. So he's saying, I know that you'll be king. You will rise. That's been promised to you. You are all good, David. But what about me? My house is not. It's almost like John the Baptist. He knew that David's house would increase and his house would decrease. And he's saying, when I'm gone, Jonathan, David, you show me the loyal love that you're asking of me. And then verse 16, Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David. He knows that it's not about them because he knows he's going to go. but he says, our houses, it's a covenant between their houses. And then verse 17, Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. Look at that's again repeated. He loved him as much as he loved himself. And we know that in the Bible it says no one hated themselves, but we nourish and cherish ourselves, which is why Paul in Ephesians uses self-love as a very high bar. Yeah, because we look after ourselves, generally speaking. It's a, my uncle has spoken on that. He exhorted on it once. I'll never forget it. Stood up and boldly said, we all need to love ourselves. And, well, I've never heard that before. And spoke about self-esteem. Maybe you could do that here one day, Uncle Steve. It certainly got everyone's attention. He then says a very powerful thing, which goes all the way back to Laban and Jacob. And many people, mum and dad included, when they got married, this was in their vows, and a little bit of it's in their wedding rings, I believe, because he cites Genesis 31, verse 49, in verse 23, the Lord watch between you and me forever, which is what Laban and Jacob said. The Lord watch between you and me when we are out of one another's sight. Very similar words. By the way, I think Laban meant it a little bit differently, but that's a topic for another day. So they agree this very elaborate plan, and then verse 24, David hides himself in the field while in the palace Saul goes and sits down for this big feast. But notably, verse 25, Jonathan is right opposite him. So Jonathan goes back into the palace with all of this backdrop. Incredibly courageous just to do that. But on the second day, when Saul sees that David's not there again, his instincts are up. Different to Jonathan, we'll see again the innocence of Jonathan in a moment. Not so with Saul. He knows something's up. He can't even use David's name. Verse 27, why has the son of Jesse not come? Not David. Why has the son of Jesse not come? And Jonathan then recounts the plan that he and David had set up. But he uses a word that I think piques Saul's interest, and he can see the hand of David. That's not a Jonathan word. That's Jonathan giving away too much in his innocency. Because in verse 29, you'll see the expression that Jonathan perhaps naively uses in his innocence. He says, let me get away, in saying what David had said. Let me get away to my family. If I found favor in thine eyes, let me get away. Now, the Hebrew there, it's literally the word or the expression to be smooth. And it's actually used in the context of to escape. Strong's and Young's both say this, to escape by slipperiness. So Saul's like, I think, Jonathan, you might have just revealed a bit too much. Are you actually telling me David said that he's going to escape by slipperiness? And maybe Jonathan sort of let that word slip out. Probably not a great choice of words, because Saul can see, I believe, the hand of David. So he explodes. Verse 30, Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know? By the way, David was right. It's all here. Jonathan was totally wrong, totally wrong. Saul says that David was right only verses earlier. Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your shame? As long as the son of Jesse lives, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. So David was right. In his innocence, Jonathan was hopelessly wrong. But he's really courageous right in this moment, because in verse 32, when it says Jonathan answered Saul, the word answered there really means to eye. And I think Jonathan here, this is perhaps the first example of almost like righteous anger. He looks Saul right in the eye, perhaps across the table, and he says, why should he be put to death? What has he done? And you know that fairly commonly held view that when logic fails you, when words fail you, you resort to screaming and yelling and abuse or violence? That's exactly what happens here. Saul has no response other than to resort to violence. Verse 33, he does an extraordinary thing. Father to his loyal son. Verse 33, Saul hurled his spear at Jonathan to strike him. And this is this righteous anger. Verse 34, Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for himself. Is this about him? Most humble man? No. He was grieved for David because his father had disgraced him. It's never about Jonathan. He was so upset with his father's attitude towards David. It grieved him. Saul was right, because that word grieved is the exact same word that David said that this is how you would feel if you know it, to carve, to be gutted. It says he was gutted for David. It's the word carve. It carved a feeling out inside him. So then we get to a pretty sad part of the life of Saul and Jonathan, because the very next morning, with a very heavy heart, we can see Jonathan trudging out into the field with the little boy, bow and arrow, perhaps dragging along behind. We see David, who's lying out there in the field. He anxiously pokes his head up and he can see Jonathan mouthing the words to the little boy, probably couldn't hear what he was saying, but then with unerring precision, Jonathan pulls back the bow and fires those arrows right over David's head. And David's heart falls. He knows this is, in his mind, the end of their friendship. Verse 41. As soon as the boy had gone, David rose and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times. And they kissed one another and wept with one another, David weeping the most. So note that David bowed in reverence before this older man, this courageous, humble, loyal, guileless man. He bowed in reverence to Jonathan, who had risked his life for him. And then it says, they kissed and wept, David weeping the most. The King James has until David exceeded. The Hebrew word literally means to wring, to wring. He cried and cried until there was no more tears. He wrung every tear out until there was no more. These are two of the toughest, courageous men in the whole Bible, and they're crying their eyes out. Did you know that David is possibly the biggest crier in the Bible? On 8 occasions, distinctly, it says that he cried. He slew his 10,000s. An extraordinary warrior, a weeper, a crier. In fact, if you go to the Psalms, he cried much more than 8 times. There's no shame in crying. It's not weak to weep. And Uncle Steve, that's one thing that I'm a little sad of, that my British upbringing, you know, I think I've got more in touch with my emotional side as I've got a bit older. But that stiff upper lip, it's not all that easy for me to let my emotion flow. But I looked into crying. I don't know if you ever have, but I looked into crying, and it's a very, very interesting what I discovered, which was all new to me, maybe not to you. But there's actually 3 forms of crying, or 3 forms of tears. There's basal tears, reflex tears, and psychic tears. Now, basal tears are what we'd be fairly familiar with, that they keep our eyes moist so that we don't suffer from infection. Reflex tears are when something gets in our eye, like a speck, and it makes us weep or cry to get rid of that thing. Now, basal tears and reflex tears are 98% water. But psychic tears are something altogether different. And I never knew anything about this at all. There's actually two words for it. Where did I find that? Yeah, psychic, the other more common expression would be emotional tears. Now, what they do, so when we cry in deep emotion that something's really moved us, two very, very special things happen. Those tears actually flush stress hormones and toxins out of our body. It's a totally, you can Google it, read research papers, it's indisputable. So those stress hormones, those toxins are actually flushed out of our system. It's like God's designed an emotional safety valve for us, which is why crying is often described as a cathartic or catharthic experience. It's a healing experience. Because what it also does is it flushes those out. But if you didn't know this, this is what I loved. It actually releases the happy hormones. It actually releases drugs. It releases oxytocins and other of the other endorphins. For those of you who are expert, Tan and Kat probably know them all. You could Google it tonight, what the happy hormones are. They're all these endorphins that literally make us, after a good cry, feel better. And I'm really delighted, and it's been really, it's a really great thing, because a couple of my mates, these two here, they're pretty good criers. They've shed quite a few tears, and it's great because I get into it, because when it's a bit like you see someone yawn, you yawn. If they start being teary, I get teary. I get teary now because you're talking about it. It's not a shame. It was really interesting at H2O, and maybe I'll do this for the men in the audience, and really please be honest, because I was amazed when I asked for a different talk at H2O. I said to the men, of the men, so men get ready, who of the us males has had a bit of a cry in the last month? Put up your hand. So that's interesting. So that's more what I expected. There's five of us. So whereas at H2O, it was quite interesting. Probably, Lizzie, I would say almost two-thirds of the males there, oh, Kirsty's here, she would remember, put up their hand. And I was really shocked, but maybe it was because they were a bit younger. Like that group sort of 35 down to about 25, and maybe a bit more in touch with their emotion, more comfortable with it than people brought up in my era. I remember the first time I cried in front of my kids, I think they thought something bizarre had happened because they'd never seen it before in their life. It was probably the only major time, actually. But anyway, it's certainly not weak to weep. David did it, and it is a good thing. In fact, repressing it leads to a lot of problems. We know that hypertension, stress, cardiovascular disease, all of that. Verse 42, it's Jonathan that is able to perhaps pull it together, the older one who can finally speak. He says, go in peace, because we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord shall be between me and you. And then he adds, because he knows it's probably not the two of them, between my offspring and your offspring forever. They knew all about the kingdom and Messiah. They were looking for exactly what we are, forever. He knew the promises, etc. It's very, very powerful insight. Now, our last encounter, chapter 23, they thought that would be it, but miraculously, Saul can never find David, but somehow, it's quite amazing, Jonathan finds him, bang. He has no issue finding David. Verse 16, Jonathan, Saul's son. There it is, every time. Jonathan, Saul's son, rose and went to David and strengthened his hand in God. Do not fear, the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel. And here's the beautiful innocence and naivety. And guess what, David? I'm going to be next year. I'll be your prince. I think that's just a beautiful, wistful, as Lucy would say, wholesome hope. I'm not sure he really believes that. I believe that he believes that in the future, but I think he'd said that to inspire David, to give him a sense of hope. And the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. It's very beautiful, that word strengthened. And if you've had a bargee hug, you'll know what this one is. It literally means to seize. He pulled him into a proper hug. Lizzie and our sister-in-law, Kel, Brent's wife, does mega hugs, like crushes you. So that's what this is, a proper hug, a big hug. And he grabs David and gives him this major hug. And the message is just like the angel in the Garden of Gethsemane to Jesus. It's all about, as we read in Isaiah and Hebrews, strengthening the weak knees and the drooping hands. David was at a really low point. And like that angel in the Garden of Gethsemane to Jesus, Jonathan seeks him out and gives him this inspiring message, which one day will be true in the kingdom. Imagine it. Jonathan will probably give David a nudge and say, I told you so, mate, I'm right here by your side. Took us a while, a few thousand years, but here I am. It's a very beautiful thing to imagine. But where does Jonathan go after that? Back to his dad. I mean, it's extraordinary. Back to fight his father's battles. Look at 1 Samuel 31, verse 2. The next time we read of Jonathan, he's with his father, and we read the tragic words. The Philistines overtook Saul and his sons. Jonathan, right there with his father to the end, and struck down Jonathan, who? The son of Saul, right to the end. The son of Saul to the very end. Loyal, an extraordinary lesson in loyalty. Our loyalty shouldn't be based on the merit of those we are loyal to. If it's our father, our mother, we are loyal. Jonathan's an incredible example of that. Verse 6, Saul died and his three sons on the same day together. Together to the very end. Now, I wanted to conclude, and I'll probably go a minute or two over time, I'm sorry, with the lament. You can't finish the story with David's amazing lament. Have a look at verse 19 of 2 Samuel 1. This is David's lament at the death of Saul and Jonathan. He says, "Your glory, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen." And then verse 22, "From the blood of the slain, from the muscle of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan, turn not back. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and death, they were not divided." There's that sense of loyalty. "They were swifter than eagles, stronger than lions." Now, just as an insight, that word glory, your glory, is actually the word for a gazelle. He's saying they were as dexterous as gazelles, as swift as eagles, as mighty as lions, extraordinary men, Saul and Jonathan. He says, despite insurmountable odds, Jonathan never took a backward step in front of the bow or the muscle of the mighty, never a backward step. He then says something I believe is really sweet. He says in the English, we would put it loved and lovable. Like Jonathan was lovable, this sort of sweet, innocent, a little naive, but so passionate, so loyal, so humble, so courageous. Beautiful little expression. And then in a really sweet way, I remember the first funeral I ever heard done was J.J. Mansfield, John Mansfield from Southern Bales, when his mum died. And he did a beautiful speech at the funeral, and he spoke to his mum like she was there. And David does that. Have you noticed this? Verse 26, he speaks to Jonathan as if Jonathan's alive. It's almost like he's putting those words on record for us, but also that one day Jonathan will hear them in the kingdom. That's what you said about me. He says, verse 26, to Jonathan, "I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women." So beautiful how he speaks to him. He's dead, but he's alive to David in that sense, just like the patriarchs are alive to God. But look at the language. I'm distressed. The word means to cramp. My heart aches for you, David. The word pleasant is often used for pleasant to my soul. You warmed my heart, David is saying. That's the expression there. Now, just a word on this surpassing the love of women. So much has been written on it, surpassing the love of women. Is it anything unusual? Is it something that we might sort of feel is a bit strange or recoil from? Not at all when we look at actually the Hebrew words. When it says there, my love for you, or sorry, your love to me was extraordinary, the best rendering of that is, or literally it means to separate or distinguish. It was separate or distinguishable from any other love, just different. Then it says surpassing, that means to part from or to be apart from. It was distinct, so distinct, different, separate, special, unique, not necessarily better. You get what I'm saying? He's not saying it's better or greater than the love of a woman that I've ever thought. It was different, unique. And that's a little bit what I was saying. The love that we can have for our mates is extraordinary, special, not necessarily better, but unique in its own very special way. So my conclusion from that is that David's saying, we enjoyed, you and I, David, a very special mental, emotional, spiritual connection that was absolutely extraordinary, something like I never experienced with anybody else, an amazing friendship.